Yeah, chapters 4, 5, and 6 on the next test. We're doing 6, then I think we get a 4, then 5. Yeah, all right, so this is about 2:41, and it is September 17th. And we're going to keep working on chapter 6. Maybe we finish this today, I'm not sure. We have a couple slides to look over. But last time, we talked about passive transport and active transport. And you should know a number of mechanisms for passive transport. Like, what are some ways that things can move passively? By what kind of processes? Diffusion's one. Osmosis is another. And then what's the third one? Facilitated diffusion. All right, and when it's a passive process, how do molecules always go? From high concentration to low concentration. That's right, the gradient is the determining factor or the motive force for moving these molecules around. All right, and then you should know what other things influence diffusion. What other things can influence diffusion? Like temperature, right, is one way. Is it directly related or inversely related? It is directly related. When temperature goes up, the rate of diffusion increases. What is inversely related? To the size. Yeah, we call that molecular weight. And I think I went over that with you last time, right? Direct versus inverse proportionality right there. So that's how we talk about those things very easily. And then what about active transport? I didn't give you a list of active transport mechanisms, but generally tell me about active transport. Requires energy. In what form? ATP. And how can molecules move? From low concentration to high. They can go up their concentration gradient. And the reason why they can do that is because ATP is expended to allow that kind of motion to take place. So when we have a protein in the membrane that can actually move molecules from low to high utilizing ATP, what do we call, what is that molecule generally called? A pump. That's right, it's called a pump. Just like you could think of it as a pump at a well where you have to raise that little lever arm to get water up out of the ground, right? That requires energy to do that. So here we have the sodium-potassium pump. And let me see, which one of these lights do I want to turn off? Maybe that helps. Maybe that helps. Okay. Okay, don't fall asleep. All right, so this slide you got to be familiar with. I don't know if this is an exam figure or not, but this just shows you that in a normal cell at rest, potassium is high on the inside and it's low on the outside. Sodium, on the other hand, is high on the outside and it's low on the inside. And it is that way partly because there is a sodium-potassium pump. And it's a pump because it can take potassium low on the outside and put it into a high concentration inside the cell in the opposite direction for sodium. But that's going to require ATP for that to function. Okay. And I introduced to you last time my automobile, I believe. All right, turn that off. All right, so we have we have my car up over here, right, on the hill like this, and it's going to roll down the hill, right, just all by itself, because there is what we call potential energy. The car has potential energy, and it can convert that potential energy into kinetic energy as it's rolling down the hill. Right, so the car by itself doesn't have to have any energy, just the position of the car on top of the hill gives it some energy. We call that potential energy. So there is energy in this gradient. It will allow the car to roll down the hill. Right? So we just give it a little push and it's going to roll down the hill. It's going to use up that energy, and then when it gets down to the bottom of the hill, will it roll forever and ever and ever? No. It will slow down, okay, because it won't have any potential energy left in it anymore. All right, well, let's think of another object that we could put. I have never drawn this before. Flying saucer, close. It has to do with flying. That's a feather. Okay, so that is a feather. We have a feather down at the bottom of this hill over here. Will this feather roll up the hill all by itself? It can't do that, right? Okay, so now let's attach this feather with a little string, for instance, and then bring the string up the hill to, and attach it to a wheel right here. So the wheel is fixed. Put the string around that wheel and attach it to the car. All right, now let me move this, at least put this little flap down. Okay, so this feather is attached to the back of my car through this little wheel. Now, let's push the car down the hill. Okay, so the car is rolling down the hill. What's going to happen to that feather? Can you see that it's going to get pulled up the hill? Even though the car is not using energy, right? Even though the engine is not on, we just let it roll down the hill. When the car rolls down the hill, it's going to drag the feather up, right? Can everybody kind of see that? Okay. So there is energy in this gradient. There is potential energy, and that energy can be used to do work, namely what? Bring that feather up. And it could. And when the car is rolling down the hill, it could lift up almost its entire weight, right? But if the weight is the same, then nothing's going to happen. Or if this feather was heavier than the car, then the car couldn't pull it up the hill. It's got to be lighter. There's got to be more energy being released when the car is rolling down the hill compared to the amount of energy that's necessary to drag that feather up. Okay. This wheel right here, that's just stationary. Let's just put a wheel so that this rope can just turn around it. Okay. So I don't have a. It's like a pulley. Yeah, I like that, like a pulley. Okay, so this rope or thread can just slide around in this direction. Okay, so it will pull the thread up through here. All right, so your body uses a mechanism like that all the time, and it is called secondary active transport, right? Because going up the hill is what? Passive or active?
Active.
Okay, going down is passive, going up is active, right? So the car passively is going down the hill, but as it's in this particular diagram, as the car is passively going down the hill, what is this feather doing? It is actively being pulled up by using some of the energy that the car is just expending rolling down the hill. So this is, when the feather is going up, that is active transport, but it's not using gasoline, it's just using the weight of the car because it's on top of the hill. So in that particular case, we call this secondary active transport. Is that what you were saying all along? Secondary active transport?
I finally get the diagram.
Okay, you finally get the diagram. Okay, yeah. So it's a pulley right there.
It's just stationary to the car.
It's stationary to the car. Yeah, it's in the ground right here. It's not going anywhere. Okay. So this is not primary active transport because if this was primary active transport in this scheme right here, what would the feather have to use to get up the hill? Like ATP or gasoline or something? But we're not using gasoline, we're just letting the car roll down the hill and it's going to pull the feather up the hill. So we call that secondary active transport because there is energy in this gradient. Right? Now, how did we get energy in this gradient? We got the car on top of the hill. How did we get the car on top of the hill? We used ATP or gasoline to get it on top of the hill, right? We used primary active transport to get the car up on the hill, but once it's on the hill, we can use that energy for other reasons, like maybe dragging that feather up, which would be secondary active transport. Okay. All right, so let's see what our body can do. Secondary active transport, all right, requires ATP to first move sodium up a concentration gradient, right, to actually create a gradient. So let's look at this little wedge right here. Let's just say that we have a sodium ion at low concentration, and let's move it to a higher concentration. So what do we call that, going from low concentration to high concentration? Active transport. It's active transport. Yeah, that's active transport. And what does that require? Energy. That sodium just won't go up the hill by itself, right, or up the concentration gradient. That requires ATP to do that. Give me the name of the protein that will do that. What's the name of that protein that will do that? That is, the sodium-potassium pump, right? It's going to move sodium from low to high. Okay, so that's just the sodium pump. So the sodium-potassium pumps will pump sodium up its concentration gradient, making it concentrated outside the cell. All right, and now it's outside the cell. What does it want to do? If there's so high sodium outside the cell, what does it want to do? It wants to go back inside the cell. So, and as a matter of fact, there is energy in this gradient. And when sodium moves inside the cell, what can it do? It can drag something along with it. Right? So when it's moving, it can drag something that doesn't require as much energy to go along with it, or even in the opposite direction, like this example with the feather we have right here. And what do we call it when that feather is being pulled up the hill by the car that's going down the hill? Secondary active transport. Okay. So another way of thinking of this, let's take a glucose molecule, put it on a teeter-totter, and so this is low concentration of glucose, and up over here is high concentration of glucose. Will this glucose molecule just move up to this location all by itself? No. It's going to require what? Some energy, right? It's going to require some energy. And look, we have some energy here. Where do we have energy? The sodium we have potential energy in the gradient for sodium. Where there's a high concentration of sodium, it will want to go down its concentration gradient. And as it moves down its concentration gradient, some of this energy right here, as this example shows, can be used to move glucose up its concentration gradient. So the motion of sodium down its concentration gradient can be used to move glucose from low to high. Now over here, I don't see any ATP that's being used. It's just the motion of sodium that's being used. But to get sodium initially from this low concentration to high, what does that require? This pump, and what does a pump require? ATP to do that, right? So that energy in ATP is stored in the gradient for sodium, and then as sodium diffuses back down, right, and it's diffusion because it's from, what, high concentration to low, that energy that in motion can be used to move glucose up its concentration. So this part right here does not need ATP. So if there is something that's being moved up its concentration gradient without ATP, you're automatically going to say, what? How would you explain that process? What would you define that process to be? That would be secondary active transport. If you see ATP being hydrolyzed, you're automatically going to think, what kind of active transport? Okay. If you see, for instance, this previous slide right here, we see sodium being moved by this pump right here from low concentration to high. That's active transport. For what kind of active transport is that? Okay, that is what we would, because you see ATP on that slide, right? If you see ATP being used, that's what we call primary active transport. If there is no ATP, but things are still going from low to high without ATP, but some other energy source is being used, like a gradient of some kind of chemical, that would be what? Secondary active transport. So that's kind of handy to be able to move things around without using ATP as long as you have some other outside energy source. So this diagram is pretty good. Maybe not as good as my feather diagram. But so secondary active transport then uses energy from the downhill movement of sodium to drive the uphill transport of another molecule. And there could be a number of different molecules, but in this particular case, it is glucose. Okay. All right, so secondary active transport. We can have two different kinds of secondary active transport. Cotransport, or symport, is the secondary transport in the same direction as the primary molecule. So in this particular case right here, We've got a transporter. It's got two binding sites, one for sodium and one for glucose. And where is sodium high with respect to the cell membrane? Is it high on the outside or high on the inside? It's high on the outside. So here we see it on the outside. So it wants to do what? It wants to roll downhill into the cytoplasm. So there is energy in this gradient. So when it binds to this protein right here, glucose is also going to bind. There's a binding site for glucose. And even though glucose is high inside the cell and low outside the cell, this transporter, because sodium is going down its concentration gradient, right, is going to change conformation and then finally open up to the inside of the cell so that both sodium and glucose end up inside the cell. So in this last picture on this slide, we see sodium going, what, down its concentration gradient, going from high to low. But glucose, since it's being co-transported via secondary active transport, glucose is going from low concentration to high concentration inside the cell. So that's a way that we can jam a lot of glucose into a cell, right, through this secondary active transport. All right, this counter-transport or antiport systems move molecules in opposite directions to sodium. So let's take a look at transport across a membrane. So a membrane by definition is an epithelium of some kind. And this kind of looks like who can describe this epithelium right here for me? What kind of epithelium is that? Well, you got to go back to your anatomy brain. What kind of epithelium is this? That is, it's simple, right? Because you just see one cell layer thick. And it is? Okay, it's cuboidal. So it's simple cuboidal. And we do have some stuff on the top, and those probably look like microvilli to me more than cilia, but it's close to cilia. Okay, so just a simple cuboidal epithelium, and then there's a basement membrane. So a membrane is epithelium with a little bit of connective tissue underneath it. So this is sort of an example of a nice membrane, epithelial membrane. All right, so let me see if I can look at this slide. So this is an example of absorption of, what are we trying to absorb? Oh, look out over here. Glucose, for instance. All right, so how do we absorb glucose from our digestive tract? Or maybe actually even a better example would be from the kidney, so small intestine or kidney. So glucose has energy value to it. So all of this fluid right here, if this was a kidney tubule, this is what would become urine. And what do we do with urine? We void it from our body. And if there's glucose in the urine, you would lose that glucose. But glucose is valuable. It has energy. So we don't want to lose glucose in urine. That would be like filling your car up with gasoline and then putting a hole in the gas tank and letting it flow on the ground if you were to urinate glucose out of your body, right? So that would not be beneficial. So even if there's low glucose concentration in this filtrate inside the kidney or low glucose concentration in the small intestine, we still can't absorb it. And how can we absorb it? Here we have, and don't forget, this part of an epithelium is what we call the apical surface, and this surface down over here is what we call the basal surface or basolateral surface. So these cells don't have the same proteins in both of these surfaces. They can be different. So the apical surface is different than the basal surface. It has different proteins. So here is the first protein. What is this protein right here? What can you tell me about this? This is a sodium-potassium pump. And is this a pump that is working by a primary active transport or secondary active transport? And why would you tell? How could you tell? I would say primary because why? Look at this right here. It's requiring ATP. I have that on the board. So that's primary active transport. You know what? This might be an exam figure right here. Okay, so let's make sure we understand it pretty well. So this sodium-potassium pump, ATP is used to move both sodium and potassium against their concentration gradients, right? So sodium is being pumped which way? In the cell or out of the cell? Out of the cell. So we have high sodium outside the cell, low sodium in, but sodium is moving in that direction because we're using the energy in ATP to make it move that way. All right, so the same thing for potassium, but it's doing what? It's going the opposite way. So potassium is being pumped inside the cell. So we have, concentrate on sodium here, we have very low sodium inside the cell because this primary active transporter is kicking it out all the time. So there's low sodium. All right, in the digestive tract and in the kidney tubule, the filtrate of the kidney tubule, we have high sodium. And we have low sodium inside the cell. Why do we have low sodium inside the cell? Because of this sodium-potassium pump. So what does the sodium want to do? It wants to go inside the cell. So there is a lot of energy in this gradient in terms of sodium, because sodium is so high outside the cell and low inside the cell, it's going to want to diffuse. And here is a membrane protein that can bind both sodium and glucose. And it just so happens that glucose is at a low concentration in the kidney or in the small intestine. It will bind to the same co-transporter. And the energy that is stored in the sodium gradient is used to actually move glucose from low concentration to high inside the cell. And since both of these molecules, both sodium and glucose, are moving inside the cell, what kind of secondary active transport is that? Moving in the same direction is called co-transport. All right, now how did I know this was secondary transport right here and not primary?
No ATP.
There was no ATP. And what was being used is the energy in the sodium gradient from outside the cell to inside the cell. So sodium loves to rush into the cell, and so much so that there's enough energy that can be used to move glucose inside the cell, even though glucose is going from low to high. So this is active transport, but secondary active transport. Okay, so now when glucose gets inside the cell, it's high inside the cell, and it is now low in the blood. Which way does glucose want to go across the basolateral membrane? It wants to, yeah, and it, how can it go from the cell into the blood? What's the process? Is that active transport? It's passive, right? Because it will go down its concentration gradient from high inside the cell to low in the blood, but glucose can't get across the membrane by itself because it's a polar compound, right? It's hydrophilic. And the inner part of that plasma membrane is hydrophobic, so it can't get through. So we need another protein, another transporter. And so what do we call that transporter that allows diffusion to take place, but it just helps that molecule move across that hydrophobic region? That's called facilitated diffusion. Right? It's diffusion. It's not active transport. All right, so you might have to go back and look at those definitions for diffusion. But remember, which way does diffusion always go? High concentration to low. Active transport is low to high. And now you know two different kinds of active transport. One that uses ATP, that is primary active transport. And if it's a coupled mechanism that uses the energy in a gradient, that's called secondary active transport. Okay. And so cells use these things to move molecules around all the time. So this particular mechanism is used for absorption of glucose from the GI tract and reabsorption of glucose from the urinary filtrate, which will become urine, so that we don't lose glucose in urine in a normal person. Okay. A couple different ways of thinking about transport between epithelial membranes. There can be transcellular transport, which moves material from one side to the other of the epithelial cells. And that's what we saw in that previous slide, was a transcellular. There's also what we call paracellular transport. That moves material through tiny spaces between the cells. So it doesn't actually move through the cells, but it moves in spaces between the cells. And paracellular transport is limited by junctional complexes that glue neighboring cells together. And remember, that's one characteristic of an epithelium. So here's an epithelium. It does not have much extracellular space. So we can see this junctional complex right here that really joins those two cells together very tightly. So this impedes the flow of material between the cells right here. And so therefore, moving things across the membrane really relies on what? Transcellular transport. Transcellular transport is by far the most important mechanism. Okay, bulk transport can be used for small molecules like glucose, but it can also be used for, like cellular fragments, relatively large molecules. It does not require transporters in the membrane, but it requires the formation of vesicles. Okay, and so it can move large molecules and particles across the plasma membrane by either endocytosis or exocytosis. So endocytosis, this top slide right here is a good example of endocytosis, where we have some particles which are way too big to diffuse through the membrane. All right, so the membrane forms this indentation, and then it folds back on itself, and then it pinches off from the plasma membrane, so now we have a vesicle inside the cell that's filled with whatever material was in the extracellular space. And now this vesicle has brought that material inside the cell. So this would be an example of endocytosis. Things can move from low concentration to high with this particular method. And to move these membranes around and form vesicles, you need ATP to make that happen. This just won't automatically happen. So endocytosis is what kind of process? Is it active or passive?
Active.
It's active because it requires ATP to move those membranes around. It's going to require microtubules and ATP to form this invagination and to break the vesicle away. And then that vesicle is going to move around inside the cell even. And that more than likely is going to require ATP to move it around as well. Well, we can have the reverse process. We can have a vesicle filled with, say, a hormone inside this vesicle, and it can butt up against the plasma membrane, and it can fuse to the plasma membrane, and when it fuses to the plasma membrane, the interior contents will be released to the outside of the cell. We call that secretion. Right, so this is an example of secretion, but generally speaking, we call that exocytosis, the cell spitting these materials out. And again, that is active transport. So we have endocytosis and exocytosis. And furthermore, there are two kinds of endocytosis. The two kinds of endocytosis, which is what? Bringing material inside the cell. There is phagocytosis and pinocytosis. So cytosis is just a cellular process. Phago means eating, so this means cell eating. This is bringing particulates inside the cell. Pino means drinking, so pinocytosis is just cell drinking. So it's going to be engulfing fluid and whatever is dissolved in the fluid. So two kinds. So if I want to label these two processes, right, for sure they're active transport, but what's another way of talking about these? What are these processes, both phago and pinocytosis? Endocytosis, because it's ways of bringing things into the cell. Right. Both require ATP to do that. Okay, membrane potential. And when you see that term, most times in this class, potential has a particular meaning to it. So when you see that word potential, what should you think of? What should you kind of be thinking about in your mind? It's the energy, yeah? That's the word that I really like to think of, okay? Potential just means the ability to do something. And what it really means is the voltage of something, right? So what the heck does voltage mean? It means a difference in concentration of electrical charges. Now, where did we run into electrical charges? and ions, for instance, right? So if we have some sodium ions over here, what's the charge on a sodium? Plus. It's a what? Monovalent cation? Should have had that on the test. Monovalent. Did I have something like that on the test? Probably. All right, so here we see one area with a lot of sodium. And we have another area on the board with what? Fewer charges. Like this. So when we separate charges out, that produces a voltage. But what can you tell me about when we have a concentration gradient? What do things want to do? They want to move, right? So that's a potential energy. Voltage is a potential energy. Just like my car is sitting up on top of this hill, that's a potential energy. It will want to move the car. Well, a voltage is potential energy as well. And, oh, what could you tell me about a normal cell? Let's put a cell membrane right here. If we put a cell membrane right here, okay, which is the inside, which is the outside of the cell? The left side over here is where? Is outside because there's higher sodium on the outside of the cell. Right? And here is inside. And just by doing that, okay, we've created a voltage. What's the kind of device that you use all the time that has a voltage, that has created a voltage? I got one in here. Yeah, a battery. And so what is a battery? It's a storage form of this gradient of electrical compounds, or compounds that have an electrical charge, right? And it is energy. So a battery is just a storage form of energy. And this is how cells actually can store energy to move things around. So the strange thing about cells, from kind of a learner's perspective, is that every cell in your body is really what? It's really a battery, which is really strange. You probably never thought of a cell in that way before, but every cell in your body is a battery. It stores energy in that electrical gradient because sodium is what? It has electrical charges on it. So instead of saying membrane potential right here, we could say membrane what? Voltage. Membrane voltage, because there are different charges on different sides of the membrane. Okay. All right, so we know, okay, so here we have a cell. See a nice phospholipid bilayer right here. And the membrane potential, or membrane voltage, is just the difference in charge across the membrane. And if a cell is alive, there's going to be a difference in charge across the membrane. And but what happens if the charge is the same across the membrane? What happens if you have a battery and you measure, if you look at both terminals of the battery? I don't know how to say this without. Okay, if you look at the terminals of, how many terminals does a battery have? Two. Okay. And if the charge is equal on both terminals, what can you tell me about that battery? It's dead. Right, that's a good way of saying it. Okay. So if the charge on both terminals is the same, that battery is dead. Well, the same for a cell. Okay. If the charge across the cell membrane is the same, or if there's no difference, if there is no gradient, right, if there's no energy in that cell, then it is dead. That's a dead cell. So that's why ions are so important to understand in terms of these cells right here. All right, well, how does that membrane potential develop? Inside the cell, we have huge biomolecules like chromosomes and proteins. And most of these proteins and nucleic acids are loaded with anions. What's the charge of an anion? It's a negative charge, right? So we have lots and lots of negative charges that can't leave because these anions can't get through the plasma membrane. All right, so as a result of that, right, there are some ions that can diffuse into the cell. So if we have, you know, millions and millions and millions of negative charges inside the cell, what's going to be attracted to the inside of the cell? Positive charges, because negative charges and positive charges attract each other, right? Okay, so we have some cations, for instance, potassium, are attracted to the inside of the cell and by these negative charges. And they can get through the membrane because there are channels for potassium. So potassium can move through. So potassium is permeable to the membrane. But sodium is not permeable. Furthermore, what else can you tell me about sodium? It is transported out actively, right? It's actively transported out because of the sodium-potassium ATP pump. And furthermore, the sodium-potassium ATP pump is even pumping potassiums inside the cell too. Okay. All right, so this equilibrium potential, this is a concept that we're going to start with. So let's look at this slide right here. Here we have a cell, phospholipid bilayer. Right here, we've got all these fixed anions. They can't move anywhere. So we have this big negative charge inside the cell. And this right here represents a voltmeter. We can measure the voltage across the cell membrane with these two, what we call electrodes. And you can do this with your automobile too, or any of the batteries that you're using in any of your little devices. You've got two electrodes. And if we put both electrodes on the inside, what are they going to measure? It's going to measure the electrical charge on the inside with one probe and the electrical charge on the inside with the other probe. And they're going to be equal. And what's the voltage going to read? It's going to read zero. All right? But the electrical charge on either side of the membrane is different. Right? So if we keep the one probe on one side of the membrane and the other probe on the other side, it's going to measure that charge difference across the membrane, which is what we call voltage, or what we call potential. And let's just say that this one right here is the reference electrode, or the ground electrode. Okay, and you can just define on a battery which one is the ground electrode, and stick the other electrode inside the cell. And when we do, we see that the inside of the cell is actually negative compared to the outside. And we see that with this little symbol here and this little symbol here. And the voltmeter, since it's negative, the little pointer is going to move to the left. And all cells develop a voltage of about minus 90 millivolts. So what the heck is a millivolt? Let's see if I can figure this out. So if this is 1 volt, 1.00, this is a volt, a millivolt is 0.01 volts. Okay, so this right here is equal to, oh wait, 1.00. Okay, one millivolt. So 90 is what? So 90 millivolts is equal to 0.09 volts. So it's a relatively small voltage, okay, but that's enough for the cell in order for it to do its job. Okay. All right, so on this particular slide right here, we said that potassium can move across the membrane, right, because it's permeable to the membrane. And let's just start initially without any potassium inside the cell. And we have potassium outside the cell. So if we have potassium outside and none inside, it's going to want to do what? Diffusion? Yeah, potassium is going to want to diffuse down two different kinds of gradients. Maybe I'll even draw this on the board. There goes the feather. So here we have a cell. Potassium can get through. And there's lots of negative charges inside the cell. And we have a lot of positive charges outside. What are these positive charges again? Potassium. Okay. All right, so let's ignore the charges right at the moment and just think of the concentration. Will potassium want to move solely on the basis of its concentration? It's zero concentration inside the cell, and it's high outside. What do we call the motion going from high to low? That's diffusion. Does that require energy? Happens automatically. So potassium will want to diffuse into the cell based on what? Just the concentration gradient alone. So that's one force that's going to draw potassium inside the cell. All right, so the first one is the gradient. I'll just put a little delta there for gradient. What else is going to draw potassium inside the cell?
The
The charge. That's the second reason why. All right, charge. All right, so those are the two forces that are moving potassium inside the cell, the concentration gradient and the charge. Okay. If there were no charges inside the cell and we let this run for a long period of time, how would you describe the concentration of potassium inside the cell to outside? After a long period of time, what would happen? It would reach equilibrium. So you would have the same concentration of potassium inside the cell and outside the cell. And when the concentration is the same, what happens to diffusion? It stops, right? So potassium is not going to move. All right. But now, let's consider this. In real life, what else do we have inside the cell? You have lots of negative charges. All right, so what are these negative charges? What's the force of these negative charges on potassium outside the cell? It's going to pull them in, right? So that's going to pull some additional potassium inside the cell, above and beyond that concentration gradient. So you're going to have a gradient of potassium higher inside the cell compared to outside the cell, because with pulling potassium in is not just the concentration, it's also the charge associated with it. Okay. So let's take a look at this slide over here. Okay, so what do we have? We have the electrical attraction pulling potassium in, right? But it can't pull. So let's just put a lot of negatives in here. It can't pull all these potassiums in to balance out these negative charges, because what happens when you pull potassium inside the cell? The concentration of potassium inside the cell becomes high compared to the outside, and when the concentration is high on the inside compared to the outside, which way does potassium want to go? Just by the concentration. It wants to go out. Okay, so you have these two competing factors. You have the concentration gradient and the charge, and that sets up a new equilibrium, right, so that there still is a higher concentration of potassium inside the cell, but it's not going to balance out all of these negative charges. So you still have high concentration of potassium inside the cell. All right, so potassium, membrane is permeable. All right, so that new equilibrium potential, all right, the charge for pulling potassium in, right, the electrical charge for pulling potassium in at equilibrium is going to be balanced by, equal to, but opposite to the amount of force that is driving potassium out of the cell by its concentration gradient. So that's what we call the equilibrium potential. If there is no potential, what would be the concentration of potassium inside and outside the cell? They would be equal. But as soon as we put some negative charges in there, it's going to draw some additional potassium inside the cell. And when the concentration gradient is strong enough to move potassium out, and that's equal to the electrical charge pulling it in, that's what we call the equilibrium potential at rest. They will cancel each other out, and when they cancel each other out, there's not going to be any net motion of potassium one way or the other. That's the equilibrium potential or equilibrium voltage. So when potassium is at equilibrium, both the electrical and diffusion forces are what? Equal and opposite. The inside of the cell has a negative charge. Right, so there's some leftover negative charge, but there is also what? There's also a higher concentration of potassium inside the cell. So here is an equation where you can actually determine what this equilibrium potential would be, right, at equilibrium. So this gives the membrane voltage needed to counteract the concentration forces acting on an ion. So which way is the concentration force acting right here in this cell? Which way is concentration moving the potassium, in or out?
Out.
Out, because it's high inside the cell, but low outside the cell. But what is, what's the, how did we put it right here? Force, yeah, it's a force. What's the force that's drawing potassium in? The electrical charge, right? So at equilibrium, it's the electrical force that's exactly equal to and opposite to the concentration force. They balance each other out, and there's no motion of potassium. And you can calculate this. I won't ask you to calculate this on a test. You don't need a calculator on a test. But there's a couple homework problems or some problems on the web for you to get a feel for this. All right, so this is the voltage. Depends on the ratio of ions on the inside compared to the outside of the cell membrane. And so if we take the concentration, that's what these brackets right here represent, the concentration of an ion outside the cell compared to the inside. You've got to remember to put the inside down over here. You take the log of this ratio, multiply it by this 61, that just helps convert units. And the Z right here is the valence of a particular ion. What's the valence? Okay, yeah, the magnitude of this charge right here. So if that was a chlorine, what would that Z be? Z would be minus 1. Okay, if it's sodium, it would be plus 1. And if it's a calcium, what would Z be? Plus 2. Okay, that's the valence of that ion. So you might have to know the name of this equation. The name of this equation is called the Nernst equation. All right, so this tells you what the voltage is on the inside compared to the outside of the cell, just based on the concentration of various ions. And the Nernst equation works great for just one ion. It doesn't work very well when we have a number of ions in solution. But in real life, do we have just one ion? We've got sodium, got potassium, got chloride, calcium, et cetera, et cetera. So this is an approximation to real life, but if this is a good place for us to start. All right. So here we have a cell, and don't forget, we have a lot of ions inside the cell that are pulling potassium in, and the concentration of sodium inside the cell is very low. It's only 12 millimolar. It's 145 millimolar on the outside. And potassium, 150 on the inside, 5 millimolar on the outside. So you could calculate, the voltage that's produced by each one of these different ions right here? You would use this Nernst equation, right? Okay. All right, so you could calculate the equilibrium potential of potassium, calculate the equilibrium potential of sodium, and you know, maybe you should do that over the weekend and see what kind of numbers you come up with. All right, and we can check them on Monday. All right, and another important ion is what? Calcium. It's almost zero on inside the cell, and it's pretty high outside the cell. That's probably something else that you should get a feeling for. Calcium is low inside the cell, but it's high in the extracellular fluid. So, okay. Oh, here's an example already for you. Well, you don't have to do it. I won't show you that. Pretend you don't have that slide. Maybe work on that over the weekend. But there are the answers on that slide. So, at rest, there is a potential that's developed. Okay, we call that the RMP, and I'll use that term a lot in the class. That stands for resting membrane potential, and that's a stable voltage, and that's the potential that a normal cell produces when it is not producing electrical impulses, when it's not communicating with other cells. And the RMP, or the resting voltage in most cells, is somewhere between minus 65 and minus 85. So what does that mean? Where is it more negative, inside the cell or outside the cell? It's more negative inside the cell. It's more negative inside the cell. And the resting membrane potential depends on what? The concentrations of ions inside and outside the cell. And something else that we really haven't talked about yet, and that is the permeability of that membrane to each of those ions. That means how easy is it for that ion to move across the membrane? And we said for potassium, it's very easy. So it's affected most by potassium because that's the most permeable. There are channels to potassium in the cell membrane. Okay, so here's a cell at rest. We have high sodium on the outside, high potassium on the inside. We have the fixed anions in here. And if we measure the voltage across the membrane, it's like checking a voltage on a battery at two different terminals. An average cell's resting membrane potential is about minus 70 millivolts. And the sodium-potassium pump affects the resting membrane potential because it is not an equal pump. It doesn't pump potassium, the numbers of potassiums and the number of sodiums in the same ratio. The sodium-potassium pump will pump two potassiums for every three sodiums, right? And as a result of that, that adds about minus 3 millivolts to the resting membrane potential. So we say that the sodium-potassium ATP pump is electrogenic because it's not just trading one charge for another, right? It's trading what? Two plus charges for three plus charges, right? And if you pump out more plus charges than you pump in, can you see that you get a little extra negative charge on the inside of the cell? Okay. All right, so here's a summary of the processes that affect the resting membrane potential, which is what? On a normal living cell, let's just say it's about 70 millivolts. We have, first, we start with those fixed anions, those negative charge molecules that can't leave the cell. And these fixed anions are going to attract potassium ions to the inside. And it really can't attract much of the way of sodium because sodium is not permeable to the membrane when it's at rest. The membrane is permeable to potassium when it is at rest to some degree. All right, so there are some inequalities in the permeabilities of the plasma membrane to potassium and sodium. All right, so what else happens? You have the sodium-potassium pump. Does it pump equal numbers of sodium and potassium? Nope, different. One is two and the other is three. Which one is two? Potassium, right, is two. Three sodiums. All right, so that's electrogenic because it's not equal numbers of sodium and potassium. So that, again, causes an uneven distribution of ions across the membrane. All right, so if we look at the equilibrium potential for potassium, it's about minus 90 millivolts, but the equilibrium potential is plus 66. And when we add those together, we get minus 70 because of the difference in permeability and the difference in this electrogenic pump, right? We just can't add these two voltages together. So that gives us minus 70 millivolts instead of what, 30 something. Okay, so let's talk about some cell signaling. How do cells communicate with each other? Some use gap junctions. So here we see some different kinds of junctions. We see a tight junction right here, and an adherens junction, and a desmosome. These glue the cell membranes together. Now, what we don't see on this slide right here is a gap junction. And a gap junction might be similar to this tight junction and a desmosome and these adherens junctions, but there is a channel in the membrane that allows sodium to go from one cell to another. So unfortunately, we don't have a gap junction on this slide. But if we have sodium that has a positive charge, when it moves from one cell to another, that's what? That's really an electrical current. So an electrical current can move from one cell to another through a gap junction. And we'll see that some cells have gap junctions and other cells don't have gap junctions. Other ways of signaling would be through the release of what we call a paracrine agent, which is a chemical So here we see one layer of tissue releasing a signaling molecule, and it's going to diffuse from a high concentration to a low concentration, go to a different cell, and it's going to cause some kind of response in the cell. And the reason why it can cause a response in the cell is because on the plasma membrane, there's going to be a receptor protein for it. There's going to be a molecule that can bind the signaling molecule or the paracrine agent. All right, so in paracrine signaling, cells secrete regulatory molecules that diffuse to nearby target cells. All right, so if this layer right here was secreting some kind of signaling compound, signaling molecule, but these cells down over here didn't have a receptor, could this signaling compound cause a response in this tissue right here?
No.
It can't. So in order for, so this is what we call a target tissue. We call it a target tissue because it has the proper receptor protein or receptor in the cell membrane. If it doesn't have it, then it's going to be completely blind and oblivious to these signaling molecules. All right, so we invoke that to explain a lot of kinds of phenomena. Like, why are some tissues sensitive to testosterone and other tissues completely insensitive to it? Because the ones that are sensitive to it have receptors for that particular hormone. Okay? While tissues that are unsensitive to that hormone don't have the proper receptor. Okay, synaptic signaling. Here we have a neuron, and neurons can cause, this is an example of, anybody know what kind of tissue this looks like here? That looks like nice skeletal muscle, for instance. It's nice and striated, and I can see the sarcomeres in here as well. So this right here is what we call the neuromuscular junction, and the structural and functional unit of communication between two cells is the following. Okay, so the structural and functional unit of communication between cells is called a synapse. That's a little model that we have in our mind. And a synapse, there are two different kinds of synapses. One is a chemical synapse, and the second is what we call an electrical. So this is, a synapse is a junction between two cells that has a functional property. It allows for communication. A chemical synapse is like the one we see on the slide right here. So within this neuron, there are electrical impulses or electrical activity that flows over this neuron. But that electrical activity can't flow into the muscle and cause it to contract. It stops here at the axon terminus. And that electrical signal then has to be converted into a chemical signal. The chemical diffuses across this space, which we call the neuromuscular junction, and it will bind to the muscle fiber right here, which will then cause that electrical signal to begin again on the muscle, and the electrical signal will flow over this whole muscle, causing contraction. So the way information travels from the neuron into the muscle is first it's an electrical signal, and it's converted into a chemical signal, which then gets converted back into an electrical signal. And the chemical signal is what we call a neurotransmitter. So neurons release signaling molecules that we call neurotransmitters. So that's the first kind of synapse, right? This is a chemical synapse because what's carrying information from one cell to another? Is it an electrical signal or a chemical signal? It's the chemical signal. And generally speaking, what do we call that chemical signal that's released from a neuron? A neurotransmitter. So there are some examples of neurotransmitters that we're going to be familiar with in this class, and maybe from anatomy you might know some names of neurotransmitters. All right, so yeah, neurotransmitters. So what are some examples? Acetylcholine is one. Another one would be norepinephrine would be another one. And what are some others that we might look at in this class? We might look at serotonin. Okay, that's good enough for right now. But you might recognize that acetylcholine and norepinephrine are involved with two different nervous systems. For instance, the parasympathetic nervous system versus the sympathetic nervous system. Parasympathetic uses acetylcholine, sympathetic relies on norepinephrine. But those are just signaling molecules that go between different cells, right, to pass information along. Oh, at the neuromuscular junction, there's only one neurotransmitter that's used. Does anybody know what the neurotransmitter is at the neuromuscular junction? That is acetylcholine. It's 100% acetylcholine, right? Okay. Okay, so this would be, so a synaptic signaling uses a chemical synapse, right? But I already mentioned another kind of communication between cells, these gap junctions, which you don't have a picture of right here, that allows for sodium to move from one cell to the other, right? That would be an example of an electrical synapse, where an electrical signal, and that is what, the movement of sodium from one cell to the other, directly stimulates the second cell. That's what we call an electrical synapse, and we don't have many electrical synapses in our body. Okay, because that electrical signal can go from one cell to the next, to the next, to the next very quickly. So any cells that are connected together with gap junctions, if you stimulate one cell, what happens to all the cells that are connected together with gap junctions? They're all stimulated. So if one cell is stimulated, they're all stimulated. So let's go back to our muscle right here. So that doesn't happen with a chemical synapse. So for instance, with a skeletal muscle, for instance, like your biceps, with all those muscle cells in there, what can we do with our biceps? We can lift a very heavy weight by contracting all of those muscle fibers in our biceps, or we can lift something very light with using only a couple muscle cells within the biceps. So we can use just a few muscles for lifting, muscle fibers for lifting a lightweight, or we can use all the muscle fibers in the biceps for lifting something very heavy. But if all of the muscle fibers in the biceps were connected by a gap junction, what would happen if you were just to stimulate one muscle fiber out of millions? What would happen to all the other fibers? They would all contract, right? So you wouldn't be able to lift up something light without, like, punching yourself in the face, right? Okay, so that's why chemical synapses are so good, because it gives you control, individual control of individual cells. As opposed to your heart, for instance. Do you want one part of your heart to contract and then another part? How would you like your heart to contract? We're going to consider that in this class. You want your heart to contract as a unit, right? You don't want part of it to contract and then another part. You need it to contract as a unit. So in the heart, there are gap junctions. So as soon as one muscle cell in the heart contracts, what happens to the whole heart? It contracts as well. Okay, so the heart is designed to contract as a unit, but a biceps or all the different muscles in your body aren't. If they were all connected by gap junctions, if all the muscles in your body were connected by a gap junction, if you contracted one muscle, what would happen? Your whole body would contract. Okay, so that would not be very useful. Okay, so here's an example of a chemical synapse. In terms of endocrine signaling, an endocrine is going to be secreted by a gland. So we would call that an endocrine gland. And an endocrine gland structurally does not have a duct. So an endocrine gland secretes a signaling molecule just into the extracellular space, not into a duct. And then from the extracellular space, that signaling molecule is going to be picked up by the circulatory system, namely a capillary. Why is it picked up by a capillary and not an artery or a vein, for instance? Yeah, because capillaries are the site of exchange, and the reason why they're the site of exchange is because capillaries are thin. They're just one cell layer thick. But remember, an artery and a vein are thick. There's many, many layers with muscle and connective tissue and elastic tissue. Right, and then even more connective tissue around all that. So things can't enter or leave the blood through an artery or a vein, only a capillary. So this is an endocrine gland. How could you tell me, why would you tell me this is an endocrine gland? By structure, because I don't see a duct anywhere. As opposed to another kind of gland, which is what we would call an exocrine gland. An exocrine gland has ducts. A good example of an exocrine gland would be like your salivary glands that produce saliva inside your head and it's carried to your oral cavity. Right? That would be an exocrine gland. But endocrine, the signaling molecules diffuse through the extracellular space, picked up by the circulatory system. And once they're in the circulatory system, where do they go? Where do they go? Everywhere in the body, right? And they will diffuse out of the circulatory system at a capillary at some other location in your body. And they'll diffuse around in the extracellular space. And if they bump into a target tissue or target organ, they can elicit a response. Now, what does this target organ or target tissue have to have in order to be sensitive to this hormone? It's got to have a receptor. Right, so a target tissue, by definition, has to have a receptor to this signaling molecule. Okay, and you know this is an endocrine gland because it does not have any ducts. All right, nonpolar regulatory molecules. So if they're nonpolar, are they stopped by the cell membrane? If they're nonpolar, they can diffuse through the cell membrane because there's that big nonpolar region, right? Those the fatty acids that are poking into the middle of the membrane. So hydrophobic region, so that's a big nonpolar region. So nonpolar regulatory molecules pass through the plasma membrane. And because they pass through the cell membrane, there has to be receptors inside the cell. And they could be in the cytoplasm or they could be inside the nucleus even. And there are some hormones that are protein in nature, which means that they're hydrophilic. They don't pass through the membrane, but other hormones are lipid molecules. Can you tell me any lipid soluble, any lipid hormones that you're familiar with? It was probably on a test. You were tested on it even last time. Like the ones that are based on cholesterol, right? All the steroid hormones, testosterone, estrogen, for instance. Progesterone can diffuse through the cell membrane. They can bind to receptors in the nucleus. And when they do that, they can affect transcription. What's transcription? What's the first step in protein synthesis? So these steroid hormones can initiate protein synthesis that can turn on the synthesis of proteins within those cells that have these kinds of receptors. Oh, some of these examples include what? Steroids, right? And thyroid hormones as well, and another kind of weird neurotransmitter, nitric oxide. We'll talk just a little bit about that. Okay, because these can move through the cell membrane. However, if they are water-soluble hormones, or what we call polar or hydrophilic, right, regulatory molecules, they can't get inside the cell. So how are they going to have an effect inside the cell? They have to bind to a receptor on the plasma membrane, and then that receptor is going to change the activity inside the cell. So we're going to look and see how that happens. And that's what we call signal transduction. How does that signal get from outside the cell? Right, the signal would be what a hormone, namely a polar kind of hormone. Insulin is a polar kind of hormone, can't get inside the cell. But somehow it has to affect the chemistry inside the cell, so that signal has to be transduced to effects inside the cell. And it's done by the way of what we call second messengers that are activated in the cytoplasm, and they mediate actions of the regulatory molecule. Some second messengers, I'll just give you a couple examples and then we'll look at a scheme. Some second messenger systems might rely on calcium, and some might rely on cyclic AMP or something called G proteins. So let's take a look at G protein. So you're familiar with calcium, right? Cyclic AMP, guess where cyclic AMP comes from? You've got ATP. How many phosphates are in ATP? Three, yeah, triphosphate, all right? And in the presence of a certain kind of enzyme, this can be converted into cyclic AMP. How many phosphates are in AMP?
One,
because M stands for mono, right? So there's one. And so what's left over? This two phosphates, that double P right there. And this molecule right here can be used as a signaling molecule inside cells. So let's see how that happens. Okay. G proteins can be part of a second messenger pathway in many cells. And this is the oldest kind of receptor mechanism there is in all life on the planet. We say it's highly conserved. So many, many different kinds of cells, whether they come from worms or turtles or mammals, have these kinds of receptor proteins for transducing signaling molecules from outside the cell to inside the cell. G proteins contain three subunits whose components dissociate when the cell surface receptor is activated. And a subunit binds to an ion channel or an enzyme changing its activity, and that could be on the cell membrane, for instance. Okay, so can you all see a cell membrane, for instance? Where do you see a cell membrane? Right, nice phospholipid bilayer. And it has proteins embedded in it, so you should also think of a membrane in terms of the fluid mosaic model. So this is what we call a G protein right here. Don't look at the regulatory model. Actually, here is, so here's the G protein. And here are the three subunits that we were talking about. Alpha is the first one, beta is the second, and gamma is the last one. Alpha, beta, gamma. And when a regulatory molecule binds to the receptor, which is outside the cell, a GTP, that's a guanosine triphosphate, that's a high energy molecule, can bind to this alpha subunit right here, displacing a GDP, right? So the GTP is stuck on this alpha. So what happens now when GTP binds to the alpha subunit, it dissociates from that triplex right here, and this alpha then can diffuse around on the surface of the membrane. On the inside of the cell, it moves around on the surface of the membrane, and it can bump into another kind of protein. Right? So this is what we're going to call an effector. An effector produces, what does an effector always produce in a response loop? A response, some kind of response. And we don't have time to go into what kind of responses, but we'll look at a number of different responses. But it's good to get this scheme down first. Or this beta and gamma subunit can diffuse around on the surface of the membrane. It can bump into an effector. And when these subunits bump into these effectors, it can change something about the effectors. Maybe this is really a channel. And when the alpha subunit's not bound to the effector, the channel is closed. But when the alpha subunit bumps into this effector, the channel opens. Okay, and when a channel opens, then something can move down its concentration gradient. So you already are familiar with one ion that normally doesn't move down its concentration gradient because it's not permeable to the membrane. That would be sodium. Potassium generally is, but sodium generally isn't. Well, let's just say that this alpha subunit bumps into a sodium channel, and when it does, it opens it up. What's going to happen to sodium? It's going to run inside the cell, and what's going to happen to the voltage on that cell? Is it going to stay the same or might it change? It might change because sodium is what? It's an ion. The inside of the cell is negative, and when sodium rushes in, then the inside of the cell is no longer so negative, right? It reduces the negativity inside the cell. And then after the effector does its job, the alpha subunit gets combined once again on the G protein over here, and the signaling molecule goes away. The GTP is hydrolyzed, and this receptor is now ready to be activated once again. All right, so this G protein here is controlled by the binding of this regulatory molecule on this receptor protein, and that can cause changes inside the cell. right, by maybe opening up ion channels, for instance. All right, so this figure right here, you know what, that might be an exam figure. All right, you might want to look that up. Okay, so be able to, you know, tell me, where's the receptor? It's right here. Where's the G protein? What does a G protein bind? It binds GTP, and that's where this G protein gets its name from, because it binds what? Guanosine triphosphate. And guanosine triphosphate is very similar to what molecule? It's a nucleotide. It's very similar to ATP. It's a high energy molecule. You just don't have as much GTP in your body as ATP. It's used selectively for certain kinds of processes. Okay, so I think, oh, that's the last slide. I didn't have, maybe last time, but I didn't today. 4, 5, and 6. So the next test will be 4, 5, and 6. So we're doing 6, and then we'll go back to 4 and 5. So this is what, chapter 4? No, this is 6. This is 6. Yeah, this is 6. Hey, Luke. Oh, yeah, thanks.
So Monday's group, you want to just get to the mailbox?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I sent you the slide. I gave him the old fire and brimstone speech.
Okay.
We talked a lot about flashcards.
Yeah, it helps.
Yeah.